Would it be your view that the regulatory boards in the Department of Commerce are vital services, or are these something that are expendable in your view?
I haven't looked in enough detail to really comment on that. I assume that they're needed services, or the commissioner would have taken some action to do something about them.
Moving on to other programs, I'm interested in knowing your view of RatNet. Applying the criteria you've suggested, I would assume this would be one of the first items you'd eliminate from the budget as we head down 4 years of reducing more than $100 million a year.
Well, I think it's clearly a candidate for privatization, and I wouldn't eliminate it unless there was a way for the service to be continued. But clearly that is one that I think we can look at privatizing and seeing if there are groups or a group. It could be a cable company, it could be a native corporation, it could be one of the communication companies that thinks that they can run RatNet as a private operation.
Would it be your view that the same level of service should be provided now in all places in Alaska that currently receive the RatNet service? Say if you have a village and that is the only source of television in that village, would you maintain a state system to just serve that particular group of villages, or do you have some view of at what point the state can pull out of this?
Well, if in a privatization study there were going to be villages that were going to be, that a private company was unwilling to take on, then the state might look at a greatly reduced system in those areas where a private entity wouldn't be able to provide the service. But I would hope that a private entity would be looking at expanding the service. One of the reasons you'd want to buy this is that you'd want to turn this into a more viable operation. And that, I think any effort to do this would have to be based on the premise that you would not remove RatNet from any village, that it would be continued.
Do you have any plans currently underway to try to privatize RatNet?
No, nothing is underway. Just that's one of the things that we think is an area that we want to look at.
How about the longevity bonus? Do you consider that to be an obligation of the state, and would it be one of the programs that you would reduce or think about reducing?
Well, it's an obligation of the state, and we have recommended restoring, although it's, since the law isn't going to be changed, we're fully committed to fully funding and supporting the longevity bonus at $250 and at 65 years of age as of July 1st, the program as it is now. I think as policymakers, though, we all have to recognize that there has to be some effort down the stream to figure out how we're going to do this, because we're, again, to just ignore the program really is a disservice to the recipients, because we're putting them in danger when we run into a high-risk situation like the price of oil falling to $10. So, and there are good alternatives. The annuity program is a good one. There are a lot of ways that have been introduced and proposed and that we fully support that will bring about a capping of the program and not a without diminishing any of the benefits.
If I could just make one last question here, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
With respect to the overall plan of the administration to bring the budget down to $1.7 billion, requiring, depending on what number you're starting from, I guess, reductions in excess of $100 million a year. And having been through this first round and attempting to do that, do you believe today that it's possible to make reductions of that magnitude only through attrition?
No, I don't think we ever thought it would be only through attrition. We're going to use attrition as a cornerstone of a strategy to do this. But we have to look at lots of areas where we're going to have to reduce costs. And I don't see this as something that we're going to avoid, because the decline curve on Prudhoe Bay is a fact of life. And we aren't going to have revenues 4 years from now to support the programs at their current level unless you wanted to impose taxes, income taxes, on the citizens. That's the only way I can see that we could support them at their current levels 4 years from now. And I don't think anybody wants to impose income taxes. So our judgment is we should be bringing down spending gradually to a level of $1.7
billion. Of course, $100 million a year isn't a particularly gradual reduction coming out of the operating budget. And I guess my next question would be, in addition to attrition, what other strategies are you going to follow in picking which things would go? We've discussed a few of them today, and you've indicated, no, you wouldn't be cutting this, and you wouldn't be cutting that. What are you going to cut? Because, I mean, I guess we're all in this together with the same dilemma, and people have made, you know, a lot of effort to reduce the budget. I'm skeptical that you can't, that you can make the kind of reductions you're talking about without getting into vital services, mandatory services, or causing extreme pain out there. I'm interested in knowing what specifically are you going to do once we've saved what we can from attrition, what then?
Attrition is an ongoing thing. It's just like the sun coming up. We're going to have attrition all 4 years.
I appreciate that, Commissioner. But that you said earlier, that's not going to get us the entire way that you desire to
No, be. Mostly because of organizational considerations. As you're, because as people leave government voluntarily, they don't necessarily leave in the positions that you can see reducing an effort. So it takes, there are organizational considerations that you have to make, that you have to implement in order to get attrition to work. But some of the other areas that the have been suggested by the governor in the campaign, for example, was more emphasis on privatizing functions. That's clearly a way to unload some costs off of the government. Most privatization studies have indicated that the services that a government receives, and these are becoming much more popular as state and local governments are faced with the same situation we have, is that you can maintain services, the same level of service or even improved services, by contracting for the services rather than by using government employees to do them. Those aren't easy to do. They have implications in terms of your labor contracts. But they're all ways that you look at when you're trying to bring the cost of government down by $100 million a year.
Representative?
Well, privatizing, that sounds good, but we're still going to have the contractual money in the budget to contract out for the services, unless we're just going to eliminate the services. Do you think attrition and privatizing are going to get us to the goal?
They'll get us most of the way there.
You think so? Even if the level of employees is about 600 reduction a year times?
Well, we have about 2,000 leave by attrition every year. And so we're obviously not using to full benefit, using attrition nearly as to the full benefit that we could use it. Again, that there are program decisions that have to be made, and we haven't done it. We haven't been here long enough to determine in the program areas where we can make significant reductions without affecting service. A lot of those are going to be through streamlining and efficiency considerations, where you're going to be able to do the same job with fewer employees. But we, in our first cut on the FY92 budget, have not defined those, but we clearly identified that as something we have to do before we present our FY93 budget.
Calling on you on that point, Mr. Representative Baker.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is just information that I'd like to share with the Commissioner, because I do have some information coming, but I'd really like you to look, Commissioner, at the state of Wyoming. The state of Wyoming has just gone through this process, and their experience over the last 2 years is about a 30% reduction in their operating budget because of privatization. And so there's a model out there, and I understand the state of Colorado has followed a similar trend because declining revenues and whatnot. So there might be some models out there that we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel, but actually we could look at what has happened in one of our sister states.
Mr. We are running out of time, Representative Brown.
I would just say I'm trying to determine whether the Commissioner is absolutely determined, no matter what, to get the budget down to 1.7, even if these strategies that you've laid out are implemented and do you think the most important goal is getting to 1.7 billion or maintaining services that are deemed to be necessary?
See, I don't, you tend to pose these as if we have this choice, and I think that it's reasonable to expect that we can do both. And I think we're headed in the direction of doing both. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say that we're going to have to, that the only way that we're going to do it is by some kind of draconian reduction in services. There's going to be change, and I think that's the thing we have to recognize in the beginning, is that things aren't going to be done the same. And that's hard for a lot of people to accept, that we're advocating changing the way things are done. But the outcomes we expect will be that the government will cost less, and the services, the vital services, will be equal to or better than they have been in the past. And we've seen that done elsewhere, and not just in large corporations and in the private sector that had to do it, but as Representative Baker mentioned, there are states that have actually been able to accomplish that same result. So I don't think it's unreasonable for us to expect that clearly it's a lofty goal that we're going after. But I think that given the kind of governor we have, who has this kind of visionary impact, this idea of looking down the road and seeing where we're going, that's not an unachievable goal, and it's something that's worth going after.
Representative Mackey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize that I wasn't here at the previous meeting. I know two subjects that I want to talk about or ask you about were covered then. However, I wasn't real comfortable with some of the responses, and I didn't come to doubt your qualifications because I'm sure you're qualified. I'm doubting your judgment on a couple of different things. The first one is the memo, the famous memo that you wrote on March 28th, and I quote, "It should be noted that you have a unique opportunity to evaluate a probationary employee to ensure that they're committed to the philosophy of the administration." That was to the commissioners from yourself. And I guess I have problems with that particular memo and trying to determine in my mind what you meant by that. Representative Moyer asked you in the last hearing what you meant, and you said that you had indicated you wanted to have a strong work ethic amongst the employees, meaning employees that like their job or like to come to work on time or enthusiastic or some of the things, pleasant to the public and different things like that. And I guess that's all fine. I think if somebody doesn't enjoy their job or come to work on time, they're probably not going to be around anyway. But it was brought to my attention that maybe you meant somebody that perhaps that was working for DNR, that if they didn't share the same philosophy about ANWR, for example, that maybe that was more in what you meant. Is that correct?
That's not correct. Let me first of all say, at the last meeting, we spent a considerable amount of time on this in the last meeting. I apologize for the phrase in the memo, it was a mistake. And I recognize that it was a mistake. If you want to criticize me for making a mistake, I accept that criticism. And it's legitimate, because I made a mistake. I'm not sure what else I can say, except that I'm sorry, I apologize. I've talked to the union about it, who was offended by it. I've talked to the legislators that were offended by it. Not all of them, unfortunately. I haven't had a chance to talk with you until now. But it was one of those things. I'm a new commissioner. I'm learning. I have a lot of things to learn. I still have a lot of things to learn down the road.
And, don't feel like
and I accept your help in helping point out the things that I need to learn.
Yeah, I understand that you recognize it was a mistake or whatever, and I'm just wondering, you know, if perhaps you're going to give a little more thought in the future to writing memos of that nature or other decisions that you may be required to make as commissioner without perhaps giving them or being a little more well thought out. The reason I was questioning, you know, that there was brought up that about the DNR and about ANWR, but I just want to be rest assured that somebody in health and social services isn't going to be required to be pro-life, for example, in order to meet that philosophy, or somebody that works for the ferry system has to be committed to privatizing runs that, say, aren't profitable. Those types of concerns, I think, are what we share as legislators, because we have to hear from those kind of people. And I see in here where you know, in your dialogue with Representative Cabina that you did retract the memo, and I appreciate seeing that, but I question the judgment. The other thing is in the area of public broadcasting. I am very supportive of public broadcasting, and it's obvious that you're trying to achieve a 5% across-the-board budget cut. Why 30% to public broadcasting? And in regards to RatNet, perhaps you can tell me, have you ever lived in rural Alaska?
No, I lived in Anchorage for 28 years until December.
My concern about public broadcasting is if you cut 30% out of the budget, that essentially means the end of a lot of radio stations, public radio stations throughout Alaska, because the number of federal dollars that they get compared to state dollars is like $2 federal to every $1 state. And it virtually means the end, not only to radio stations in my district, but throughout most of rural Alaska. And your attitude about RatNet, you know, that, oh, we can just privatize it out. In rural Alaska, since you haven't ever lived out in rural Alaska, maybe I can explain to you that public broadcasting on radio and RatNet television in a lot of areas is the only form of communication they have with the outside world. And, I mean, it gets down to public safety aspects. It gets down to just general common decency that we can provide all residents of Alaska some form of communication. Now, maybe in the urban areas where you have several different television stations and you have access to news and newspapers and different things, maybe it's fine and great that maybe public broadcasting dollars can be shifted in the areas that need it, but just arbitrarily cut 30% and indicate through conversations you've had with APRN people that maybe, you know, this is just the first this year and next year maybe we'll get another 30%. I find that totally insensitive to rural Alaska or to areas that need public broadcasting. And you mentioned to Representative Brown that some of the opinions and memos and articles you've written and other things, maybe they're not cast in stone, that you're subject to changing your opinion if you can understand, you know, where you need to change. I would hope that you would really seriously consider your stand on public broadcasting and make that one of the things you might be willing to change your mind on. Maybe just some thoughts. I know we're almost out of time. I had problems with those two things, and I have to tell you on the record I had problems with them, and I'd hope you'd consider those.
Mr. Chairman, I made it very clear from the beginning that the public broadcasting reductions, and I've urged the commission, I've met with the commission personally, and I've urged them in writing as well, that they establish a priority in terms of allocating their budget, their grants, and that the priority be based on making sure that no community that relies on public broadcasting for its sole source of news should be adversely affected. That they should start with that presumption, that that's their basic, and I think in their mission statement that indicates much more of an appropriate mission. It's when you get to the radio, to the communities that have more than one radio station or more than one television station, that the need for the vital need for the delivery of public broadcasting, I think has to be questioned, and I've urged the commission to follow that kind of a criteria.
Just one final comment. I'm sure, Mr. Taylor, you have a lot of experience in business and so forth, and you may very well be qualified to be commissioner. But I would ask that you consider that all state-provided services and agencies shouldn't only be run from a corporate aspect or from a business aspect. There are a lot of services that we provide to people of the state that are essential services that can't pay for themselves or are not going to be profitable, and I'm referring to the ferry system and other things. And I would hope that you would be sensitive to some of those kinds of things and not try to strictly run the state as a business, because there's no way we can do that. And I think a lot of people would share my opinion on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one of my questions already asked, and I just have two short ones. I think they're short anyway. And I know you said earlier that Lieutenant Governor Cogman had a lot more government experience than you do. And in fact, you come from the private sector, and the transition is not easy sometimes in a top government job. And I think some things are obvious in terms of how you conduct yourself with honesty and integrity, no personal gain, file conflict of interest statements. I think you've recognized, too, that sometimes you have to enforce laws you don't like, and you said you would support a merit system, and that's good. And some not-so-obvious things like exercising discretionary authority only in the public interest. There's a right to know by the public, the press. I guess what I'm asking is, when you show up for a job like this, either what have you asked for or what have you been given that kind of help you how to be a commissioner, Kip? And I'm sure you've read the executive branch code ethics and such, but
I received a lot of help from the outgoing commissioner. I met with Frank Baxter probably three or four times. He came to Anchorage and gave me a thorough briefing. We got a fairly large book that was prepared by the Cooper administration, each commissioner did, but the one I got from Frank Baxter had a detailed description of each division, which I had a chance to review, and then he was very open to questions. I came the weekend before the inauguration, and he had a meeting of all the directors, all his staff, and we had a large meeting on a Friday afternoon on Monday of the inauguration, in which we had a chance to personally meet everybody. And as far as the transition, I think I owe him a great deal of gratitude for the effort that he took to make the transition as smooth as possible. Beyond that, then you just plunge in. I mean, there's no other way that I could see to do it. You just plunge in. I've had quite a bit of experience serving 6 years on a school board, as Betty will, I'm sure, Representative Bruckman will be glad to point out, that has a way to teach you an awful lot of good lessons. Not all of them, and it's because I've learned a few more. But so you have a certain amount of sensitivity about how the public process is supposed to work and what your responsibilities are.
There's no formal workshop, but we freshmen were encouraged, not quite required, to attend to a previous week before a session of orientation, which would cover the whole gamut of what we could expect and what was expected of us. But I take there's really no such thing for incoming commissioners. But one other question, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Moyer.
Back to this report here from Commonwealth North, there was one thing there caught my eye, that the practice by individual legislators of viewing unspent revenues as their money, even if other practices of great merit, must stop. And your department acts as a pass-through. Quite a few legislative or designated grants or capital projects, no matter who's they were, governors or legislators, go through DOA. And what unspent revenues are you referring to in that?
I think that's probably municipal grants, as I understand it now. And I still have a lot to learn about municipal grants, because I'm learning from the legislators that are asking about unspent funds and so forth. So.
Well, I know sometimes seem different on the inside than they did on the outside, and I see this as viewing or relating to, well, discretionary grants. We all know that each legislator has a certain amount of money they put into their district capital projects. The governor does his statewide, and I would maintain that if a project the governor recommended money be spent on, it wasn't done, he'd probably want to redirect the funds to something he thought was good. And I don't think it's any different than what legislators do in their own district. I don't personally support legislators trying to grab money that was, you know, not theirs, if you use your word. But I think there are occasions when funds are replaced by a legislator in a district, and if for some reason they're not spent, that they probably are in a real good position to decide where they should be redirected.
Well, we'll probably agree in some areas and not in others, but our proposal has been to use this matching grants philosophy as the best way to distribute funds to a community. We think that the decision should be made more at the local level in terms of priorities rather than at the state level. And we think that there should be an incentive for the local communities to pony up part of the funds for the grant. So in effect, making the community make a sincerity pledge on whether this project is really worthwhile or not, because if they're willing to put some money into it, then that usually means it's a good project. So our approach has been, through this matching grant process, to try to alleviate some of these things we've seen in the past where decisions may have been more oriented around a pork barrel type approach.
Mr. Chairman, I Chairman, I won't have any follow-up, because I know you want to get to the billions.
Final brief comment, Representative Grunberg? Anybody from the committee?
Yeah.
Representative Grunberg?
If you were asked by the administration to interpret and administer a law that appeared to you to be inconsistent or violative of the legislative expressed language or expressed intent, what would you do?
I'd call the Attorney General. I wouldn't make that call on my own.
Other comments from the committee?
I'm not finished.
Representative Grunberg? Have about 2 minutes, sir.
With respect to the call to the Attorney General, do you believe the Attorney General would necessarily give you a totally objective answer in those circumstances?
I think so. The relationship I've had so far with the Attorney General and with the people in the Attorney General's office has been what I would consider favorable and positive. They're ethical people. They don't want to do anything that breaks the law. They have a code of ethics, professional code of ethics, besides the employment aspects of ethical conduct. So I think that I could trust a decision that I received from the Attorney General.
Are you aware of the advice they've given on the Sokolov-Schreier nomination? Those series of questions?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Keller, Senate Bill 18 going to the House floor probably this week. I suspect it will pass. What would be your recommendation to the governor?
Well, I haven't read it for a while, but if it still has a board that's not accountable to the public, that's been the part that we were most concerned about. If the board isn't accountable to the public, then we have been
recommended
vetoing it. Yeah.
And on public broadcasting, obviously both bodies here are fully funded. Your recommendation to the governor?
Well, we... from the very beginning, all the commissioners submitted budgets, and we took an oath that said we would support these budgets. So, but again, the governor is the elected official.
But your recommendation to the governor will be to veto 30%?
My recommendation would be to accept the budget that I presented in January. But again, he's the elected official, and he reserves the right to...
Naturally.
Change any of our
we all know he's the boss.
That's right.
That's another point.
Well, yeah, I'd like to know on public broadcasting, the 30% is what basically the budget that you presented in January was a 30% cut. You are going to recommend a 30% cut?
The only way that I could justify changing that is to cut something else. And the other things that I would have available, the major part of the budget are the Pioneer Homes and the longevity bonus. That's three-fourths of my budget is the money in the budget is the Pioneer Homes and the longevity bonus. And I do not propose any cuts in those programs, any reduction in vetoes in those programs. And that's the only way that I would see if you're going to try to restore those monies. And secondly, I think that the public broadcasting will do okay. They certainly would like to have more money, and they but I'm still convinced that they'll get through this and they'll be stronger as a result of it.
I just wondered what qualified you to make that statement, because they're going to lose a heck of a lot more federal money than they are state money. And I would hope that you would consider that, not recommending 30% cut. And perhaps it is possible that if you're not going to be willing to consider cutting 30%, that could mean that maybe the budget can't be cut in some areas, and that we have to live with that. And I guess maybe is there a pride factor at stake here, or what? Because it's the end of public broadcasting.
Let me say this: to the extent that we want to make a 5% reduction in spending, and I wouldn't have any problem at all if those funds are restored. I'm not going to go in there and say that they should be cut just for the sake of cutting. But each of the commissioners is committed to the budget that we presented. And if funds are restored in public broadcasting, they're going to have to come from somewhere. If they don't come out of my budget, they may come out of some other commissioner's budget. And there may be appropriate areas in another commissioner's budget that should be cut. I don't know that at the present time now. But your question is, I'm not in this for a punitive purpose. If there's more funds that can be given to public broadcasting, and we can still meet our budget target, then I'll support that budget.
I think the legislature thinks so. They put the money back in. Does that have any weight at all with you?
Well, except the legislature put $300 million back in over what we requested. So that does have some weight.
I think you'd have a disagreement.
In fact, we've got a $300 million gap that we have to close between us.
I have opinions on the $300 million, too. And I liked a lot of things you said, but this one, public broadcasting, is one I could revisit.
Mr. Keller, I certainly appreciate you being in front of the committee for probably close to 5 hours. I disagree with you on a number of issues, as obviously some people do, but I would like to commend you for standing here in a positive manner and respectfully answering our questions. And I hope that you'll look upon this committee work as respectfully asking those questions to try to get us to come to make a decision on our recommendation for you as a commissioner. I appreciate your time and look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you, sir.
And I appreciate the opportunity to come. And I also I enjoy this kind of dialogue. I think all of us have to get used to throwing hard punches and taking hard punches. That's part of public service. And I enjoy this kind of
Do we ever change your mind?
Pardon me?
Do we ever change your mind?
My mind changes quite a bit.
Do we change it today?
Thank you, Commissioner Designate. Does this need a motion? Just a
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's your choice.
Well, give me a logical reason for waiting.
He wants
it by Wednesday.
Said, and I want to talk to some people. It's up to you. It's your choice.
We've never made a motion.
You can report it out. It's up to you. I
don't personally.
I would recommend that we wait until the next meeting.
I was thinking.
You want to wait, too? All right, the next item on the agenda will be House Bill 266 by Representative Barr, an act including service in the Bureau of Indian Affairs Contract School as BIA Service Teachers Retirement Systems. Is anybody here for that? Thank you. We are rather short on time. I apologize to the committee. I hope you've read this bill. Looked at the recommendations. State your name for the record and your position.
My name is Tom Ackerley. I'm a staff member for Representative Navarro. basically, we are trying to correct a small little problem with the BIA contract service employees. Basically, BIA, when they phased out in Alaska, the REAA took over. We had 10 or 15 teachers in one district where the takeover was slow. They were left out. We're trying to make it possible for them to buy into the retirement system.
In a nutshell, questions from the committee on this bill? Representative Groomberg?
Yeah, my staff and I have a question concerning the retirement and benefits fiscal note. As this committee remembers, whenever we have retirement bill, often it comes up as a zero fiscal note, but they usually have a backup sheet showing the effect on the retirement benefits system itself. I don't see a sheet number two here, and I'm wondering.
Someone here from retirement and benefits, which join us please at the table. Just pull another chair up there. Just stay there. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Dave Stout. I'm representing the Division of Retirement and Benefits. On our fiscal note, it's representing no administrative cost, and I'm not really not sure why the fiscal backup isn't there. I was not responsible for preparing this. However, we do have a letter from our actuary saying that the cost is negligible because there are so few people impacted by this particular piece of legislation. I think we're talking of 3 or 5 individuals across the whole state.
Usually, Mr. Chairman, yes, I understand that's a very small number. And my recollection is at one time Representative Choquette had an amendment to a bill that had one additional employee. I thought that was, I think that was somewhere around $600 a year or something like that. But I think that for the sake of completeness, if we're talking about five, you're talking maybe $3,000 a year or something like that. Is that what we're talking about?
Honestly, I have no answer.
I frankly would at some point like to see that second sheet put on there for the sake of completeness. I don't say it has to be in this committee, but I think before it reaches the floor of the House, it should be there.
The staff will note that, and we'll make sure that it's requested to go on to Finance Committee.
And I do have one more question. In 1985, my freshman year here, I introduced and was enacted into law, I believe, House Bill 74, which dealt with certain BIA service to be credited. It was a very similar bill, and I'm wondering if, in fact, this is already covered because of that particular bill. If you look in the 14th state legislature, for the bills I introduced, I think it was House Bill 74, and find out where that amended. It amended something very, very similar to this, and I think it may have even amended this section of the law, but I don't remember. And I'm
Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, it's really more of a question of curiosity. I'm not very familiar with the BIA system, but was there once a school in the Kenai or something? How did associate Mike McGuire with BIA?
What happened is one of the affected teachers is now employed in on the Kenai Peninsula, and he originally was in GVAC when I was in Kenai, or in Soldana High School. And that's how he came to our attention.
I'd like you to look at the language that's presently in here in subsection, or maybe subsection A. It includes service in a full-time teaching position as a Bureau of Indian Affairs professional educator in a school or a school system operated by the BIA. And now you're going to include basically contract schools. I gather a contract school is not a school that was operated by the BIA, and that's the problem?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There was a period when the Alaska BIA was getting out of the education business, and for the most part, our EA schools were picking up most of these schools on a regular basis. There was this one little pot of schools in western Alaska that for a period of 3 or 4 years, I believe, the individuals were not federal government employees any longer. The federal government was not directly paying or writing their paychecks each month, nor did we have an REA in place at that time, so they were officially not an Alaska school district school. Kind of fit a private school in it, but in fact they didn't charge tuitions, so they were kind of an in-between situation. They weren't federal government schools, they weren't an REA school for this critical period of time.
Just a matter of drafting. This could have been cured by not having a subsection B, but by having on line 9 operated or contracted, just adding the phrase or contracted by the BIA. Now, what you have here is you have it more narrow than that, because the only time it could have been contracted was after the time the BIA school was operating, the school was operated by the BIA, and before the school was operated by the school district or REAA. And what I'm suggesting is a slightly expansive wording But I don't want to have to see this section back before us again. What I'm wondering is whether we could have a more, just a simpler amendment and say operating or contracted by the BIA.
Is there any right, there, anything wrong with doing it the way it's been here, Representative?
Well, it's narrower. See, it only applies to the schools that were contracted after the BIA operated the school and before they were turned over to the state. You may have somebody and somebody else who's come back in a couple of years who doesn't fall into that particular time period.
Well, certainly by making it narrower, we were able to better define the fiscal number. If it was broader, there may be other contract schools that the BI had all through their history, going back into the 20s, that would make it individuals eligible to pick up this type of service at this rate.
Are we going to see this back before us again because of somebody who falls into that category?
Well, certainly over the last 8 years or 10 years I've been with the Division of Retirement and Benefits, there's always somebody that's missed by a piece of legislation.
Other comments on the bill? Which is the committee? Representative Miller, or Baker.
I move the bill with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Here no objection, House Bill.
Fix it to finance.
266, which looks fine to me, is moved with individual recommendations. Members of the committee, please note that tomorrow morning we also have confirmation hearings on Mr. Jack Anderson, Commissioner Designate for Alaska Public Offices Commission, and Mr. James Hamilton, Commissioner Designate for Human Rights Commission, and then we will have our regular meeting on Wednesday. 11 o'clock.